Jeff Blair loves to commute. Let him join you on yours. Subscribe to podcasts of The Jeff Blair Show at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
So around about 1942, 1943, in that time frame when the Second World War was on at the height, there were some 80 NHL players who were serving either in the Canadian Armed Forces or with the United States Armed Forces. Think about that, 80 hockey players. I mean, we've often, those of us who cover baseball, we've often celebrated the baseball players who went into military service and who took time out from their career to serve their country and to, you know, to do the deed, to do the work that needed to be done. I don't know. I guess hockey we do to a certain degree, but I found it refreshing this year, and maybe because it was the recent incidents, the deaths of Corporal Nathan Cirillo and Patrice Vincent, that kind of made us think a little more in a more focused fashion about something we should think about a lot more in our lives. But I think this year there was kind of a very quiet sense of the need to study, the need to remember, as far as sports fans go, what the Second World War meant to the people who played the games that, you know, we still cheer, but also the people who went overseas and served their country, in a lot of cases interrupting very productive careers to do so. To me, one of the most remarkable stories is the story of the Boston Bruins Krautline. Milt Schmidt and Woody Dumart and Bobby Bauer, I should say, three guys from Kitchener, all joined the Boston Bruins, played in the same line, formed the Krautline, all went overseas to serve Canada during the Second World War in the Royal Canadian Air Force. And there's we've got some footage up on the Sportsnet website right now of a game on February 11th, 1942. And that was the final game before the Krautline was going to depart to serve Canada. The Bruins beat the Montreal Canadiens 8-1. Schmidt, Bauer, and Dumart had 22 points between them. Think about that. 22 points between them. And in tribute to them, not just as hockey players, but as Canadians. Of course, the trio received a tremendous emotional send-off at Boston Gardens. But the most important thing, both Montreal and Boston players hoisted the players on their shoulders and carried them off the ice. We've got some of that footage on Sportsnet Thoughts. It is absolutely remarkable. Milt Schmidt was the cornerstone of that great line. He is a Hockey Hall of Famer. He served his country, and we're very pleased at this time to be joined by Milt Schmidt. Milt, thank you so much for doing this today. And as you know, I guess those of us who have been lucky enough to never have to take up arms, or lucky enough to never have to do that job, we thank you for your service.
Well, I'm pleased to be with you. The only thing is, it's been so long, and my age, of course, is 96 years of age, and I'm a little frightened not to remember everything that I'd like to say. But, however, I probably do remember the finer parts of the going overseas and coming home, and obviously, coming home was the most important, and so I'm here along with many thousands of others, and also I'm really grateful coming back from overseas after spending 3 years there, and I am very grateful to be able to say I was over there for 3 years, and I'm here for the remainder, and join the Boston Bruins once again.
Milt, what do you remember about that that game against the Montreal Canadiens. As I said, we're so lucky because there's some terrific footage of it. And, you know, as someone, look, I'm 54 years old and I'm watching something that happened in 1942, and it's making me emotional. I've got to think that for you and Woody and Bobby, just that sense of respect had to be just absolutely remarkable. And let's face it, I mean, back in those days, and the Canadians and the Bruins, you guys weren't exactly the best friends, were you?
No, not exactly friends, but just goes to show you what hockey's about even today, I hope, and that is that regardless of what happens on the ice, off the ice, we're still friends. And we were quite capable of being friends with the Montreal Canadiens due to the fact that we used to travel with them after a game on a Saturday night, and we'd probably play someplace where we both would be on the train itself, and we'd say hi to one another and talk to one another that night. And just goes to show you what a relationship there is between the fellow members playing hockey. I hope that they have the same relationship going today as we did during our day.
Milt, when you went overseas, you know, one of the things that I find really remarkable about this is, you know, you played junior hockey with Woody and Bobby. They were childhood friends. You went to the NHL together. You went overseas together, and you all came back, and you were able to resume your careers. Was there ever a point where you guys were saying goodbye to each other, or was there ever a point where somebody may have said, hey, you know, hopefully we're all back here together, because it is war, you know? Things happen. There's an element of danger there. Was there ever that concern that maybe one of the three of you wouldn't make it back, or maybe all of the three of you wouldn't make it back?
No, never did we ever think that way due to the fact that we were so close. As a matter of fact, Bobby was the first to come home due to the fact that he was not in good health. And Bobby came home first, and but Woody and I were over there until the bitter end, and Woody was stationed at a place by the name of Topcliff, and I was in another station called Middleton St. George.
Mm-hmm.
But we always were able to put our leaves together, and we always went in the same place, and except Bobby, of course, and he left early due to the fact of his health was not good. But I must say that we never ever gave it a thought about Woody not returning or myself not returning. It was just a great experience, and as I said earlier, we can readily admit that we came home and along with millions of others and millions of others who did not come home, we felt sorry for them.
Now, Milt, when you guys did come home and stepped out in the ice, the first thing you probably noticed is somebody had introduced a red line to speed the game up. How different was the game when you came back and when the line got together and when you were reunited and ready to go again? How different was the game?
Well, I must say it was a complete difference of hockey altogether. The red line, they said that they put it in to create a lot of scoring, et cetera. We found it more difficult due to the fact that the style that we had was to carry the puck in all the time. We used to catch quite a scolding from Art Ross if we changed our style of skating, and that is the fact that you work so hard to get the puck in the first place, and now you give it right back to them when you get over the court for the line. And of course, when we got over the line, when we got back, why, we followed suit with everybody, and that is to dump the puck into the opposition zone, and the emphasis then was on forechecking. But not when before we left. It was the red line, and we carried the puck in all the time, and which they don't do today.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish that some coaches would get back to the old style of many years ago, plus the fact that you'll see a lot more stick handling and playmaking and individual work by far. And it's quite a change. But we managed to do look forward to it, and we worked hard at it in practice and et cetera, through the activity of Art Ross, who was our coach and general manager at that time. Through his help, we gradually decided to play the style that they played today.
Milt Schmidt joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. One of the stories that we're going to be joined by Kevin Shea, who has done a profile on you for the Hockey Hall of Fame. But Milt, one of the stories I really love is the fact that, as I said, you guys were called the Kraut Line, which in World War II is probably not the most politically correct name for a line. Now, apparently, the story is that in Boston, they held contests to do away with the Kraut Line name because they didn't think it was appropriate in the Second World War. And somebody who won the contest actually called you the Buddy Line. And the story is it didn't last very long. Once you got back, everybody just kind of looked at the line and said, yeah, it's got to be the Kraut Line.
That is very true. And I don't know what the how they ever got to be changing our line from the Kraut Line to the Buddy Line. That I don't know, but at the time, it seemed like a good idea. As a matter of fact, the day I left Kitchener to go overseas, my mother and sister were at the doorstep. They were crying like babies. Oh, they were never going to see Milt again, but I fooled them. But anyways, I got halfway down to the car that was there to take us to the railroad station. And I turned back and I went to Mom. And I said, Mom, do you mind if I change my name from Schmidt to Smith? She says, you can do anything that you want to. Well, I gave it further thought. And I said, the heck with it. What was good enough for my mother and dad is good enough for me. So I went over there, and I was the first Canadian on this bomber command station. It was a Canadian station eventually. And they treated me with open arms, and I helped them in the soccer games and the cricket games, and taught them a little bit about baseball. And it was just a great station to be on.
Listen, Milt, we really appreciate you joining the Jeff Blair Show today. Thanks so much for doing this again. Thank you very much for your service, and thanks so much for just thanks for the wonderful career, the wonderful service, and for the great memories you shared with us today. Thank you very much.
Well, it was a pleasure, I can assure you, and I thank you very much for being on with you and getting to know a little bit about what happened and what didn't happen.
Milt, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
That's Milt Schmidt, the great Milt Schmidt, Hockey Hall of Famer. You got it. I mean, you got to do some reading in this guy's career. Got it. If you can find footage of that line, it's a remarkable story, and it really. And like I said, I think it's important at this time that you know, we're all trying to search for ways of honoring the people who need to be honored on Remembrance Day, and kind of trying to tie it in with sports and seriousness of one thing versus the, you know, total lack of seriousness in the broader context of sports. And it's sometimes you find a nice kind of a nice juxtaposition, and this is clearly one of those cases. And I want to thank Mike Farwell, who used to work at the station and who, along with Travis McKenzie, did yeoman-like work in tracking Milt Schmidt down and getting Milt Schmidt to come on. It was indeed a real, real pleasure to talk to him. And quite frankly, there's probably no one else I would rather have spoken to at this particular time in this particular day. So we appreciate that. Kevin Shea, boy, I don't know how many people have written as much or know as much about hockey during and after World War II as Kevin Shea. He's written a dozen hockey books. He's editor of publications for the Hockey Hall of Fame. Used a lot of his research on Milt Schmidt extensively in preparation for the show, and we're very pleased to be joined by Kevin Shea. As I said, never mind the fact that his Twitter handle is Barilko, which... just on its own is reason enough to have anybody on. What a great story Milt Schmidt was. What a great story the Kraut line was.
Extraordinary. I was so pleased just to catch the last part of it. I had to run back from a Remembrance Day service of our own here at the Princess Margaret Cancer Center, and so I missed the beginning of it, but what a thrill, and what an extraordinary man in every way. Not just the military side, not just the hockey side, but here he is espousing to the listeners his wonderful stories and so poignant for Remembrance Day.
We've started, I think, in hockey, and maybe it's because we, you know, there are anniversaries coming up, and we like anniversaries. We like neat numbers, right? The 75th anniversary of this is for some reason, it's something we focus on compared to the 74th or 76th. It's just the way we are. But I think this year, because of what happened, because of the deaths of Corporal Nathan Cirillo and Patrice Vincent, because hockey was kind of connected to it in that there was a hockey game scheduled in Ottawa that day and it was canceled and it was replayed. We know all that. Kevin, my sense is that people, I mean, I see it in my own household. People are paying a little more attention to what this day is really about. And you know what I think is really cool is people have kind of figured out that Remembrance Day, it can be a lot of things to a lot of different people. You can use it to remember parents, family members who were lost in battle. You can use it to honor parents, family members who are still in service. I mean, there's a significance to this day this year, I think, that we haven't had in the past. And in some ways, I think that's kind of helped maybe people who want to dig a little deeper find out about the role of hockey in all this and just what hockey was about in the Second World War. There seems to be more of an interest in it.
Well, you've nailed it on several fronts here. One is that it's the 100th year anniversary of the beginning of the First Great War. So that's come to the fore a little bit more. There's a display over at the Hockey Hall of Fame. There's been articles written a little bit more than would ordinarily have been surfacing that way. And the milestones of the Second World War and the conclusion of the Second World War. But I think certainly Corporal Cirillo's passing at the War Memorial really, really brought it into focus for all of us. And you're right, the hockey ties, the fact that the Leafs were in the hotel overlooking the War Memorial and knowing that the game was tenuous for a little while and then canceled, and wisely so shortly thereafter, and the boys returned home. And then for them to return together in a really kind of under-the-radar sort of way, both the Senators and the Leafs, on Sunday morning to go to the War Memorial and lay the wreaths with the captains performing that duty really, really drove it home. I'm quite active on social media, as are most of your listeners, and I've never seen so many tributes, not just poppies, but tributes to grandfathers, to fathers in some cases, and mothers, grandmothers, etc., who served in the war, who lost their lives in the war. And I think on the shoulders of all of these relatives, people that we knew, whatever, we're here today and able to enjoy our freedom as well. So it's driven home with the recent events, certainly the milestones that you talked about as well.
Kevin Shea joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. How did the NHL change in the 40s as a result of the players who left and just some of the logistics of the game? Because I have to admit, I mean, I'm not a hockey historian, but doing some reading on it, the game really changed, didn't it? It changed because of the Second World War.
Well, it definitely did. First of all, it was a seven-team league in 1941-42. There was a team called the Brooklyn Americans who had been resurrected from the New York Americans, but they played, and that was their final season. They had had financial troubles for some time. The fact that the war had broken out, and really, although it broke out in 1939, Canada didn't get involved until around 1942 or so, and the Americans just weren't able to carry on, so they suspended the operation of that franchise, and in fact, they never did come back to join us. So it became a six-team league as of 1942-43. That was the beginning of the glorified 25-year history of the original six. And so that was the way it began to start off with. So a six-team league all of a sudden. And then all of a sudden the boys started to drift away, and superstars like Milt Schmidt, who we spoke of earlier, and others. I mean, even his entire line, and I know you addressed that, but you know, Bobby Bauer and Porky Dumont going off to war as well. An entire line, the best line the Boston Bruins had, going en masse to serve in the war. The New York Rangers, the same sort of thing. They lost their top line, the Colville brothers, Mac and Neil Colville and Alex Shabicki. And this goaltender, Sugar Jim Henry, that they had as well. And they went en masse to serve their country as well. So I'll address those two to begin with. I mean, the Rangers weren't able to fill the hole in the crease. They tried a number of guys. There's funny stories. There's the great story of the puck goes Inski-Bazinski, Steve Bazinski, who came from out west. They tried to find a goaltender. He tried. He played a handful of games, and his bow-legged stance just wasn't able to hold back the hordes, and the Rangers plummeted, not just because of goaltending, but they lost the offense as well. The Bruins surprisingly continued their offense. They did quite well. But you never can replace the leadership and the offense of the line that left, rather. With Toronto, it was similar. I mean, the guys, Conn Smythe was such a nationalist, rather. He had served in the First World War. He was a prisoner of war. And then in the Second World War, he had to fight to serve once again. And I'm not being facetious here. He had to fight. He was too old, and they didn't want to allow him to serve again. And he had to state his case over and over again until they finally acquiesced and allowed him to serve in the Second World War. He became a major at that point. So there's all kinds of revisionist history about Conn Smythe. But one of the things that certainly is part of it is that he was so proud of his country and serving his country that he asked all of his charges, both the guys who were playing in the blue and white, but also the guys who were of age who were in the minors, playing with the Pittsburgh Hornets, maybe even playing junior hockey towards the end of their junior careers, to sign up as reservists, meaning that they would get their training beforehand. Now, that meant that they lost a great deal of manpower on the ice at that time. The guys weren't going to serve their country at this point, but they were going into the reserves to be prepared. But that meant that when they were starting to call for boys to serve their country, they would be the first ones called. Anyway, guys like Cecil Apps, who was the captain of the team, Turk Broda, the all-star goaltender. I mean, it goes on and on. Wally Stanowski on defense, who's here with us, still with us here today, rather, I should say. Gay Stewart, who was the young superstar. We could go on and on, but Sweeney Schreiner. All these guys who were really stars with the team at the time served their country, some more than others insofar as their time away from the team. But it meant that the Leafs had to find some players to fill the holes, and they brought in some university players, which was quite odd. And I'll be totally transparent here. One of them was my my uncle, a guy named Jack McLean, and playing with the he was with the University of Toronto and going to engineering school. But he'd been a good local hockey player, and all of a sudden he's a 19-year-old boy being signed to play with the Toronto Maple Leafs to fill in during that time. And he was also a reservist too. But there was a number of guys, Windy O'Neill, you know, some of these gentlemen who've long evaporated to history, but who are now thrust into the spotlight with the Toronto Maple Leafs, and they were good young players. In many cases they were 19, 20 years old. They were a little bit on the small side too, but they stepped into the breach and served as Toronto Maple Leaf players. Sadly for them, fortunately for fans and for the Leafs themselves, that when the war was over in 45, the stars that we talked about, the Apses and the Brodas and the Gay Stewarts, Stanowskis, whatever, came back. They moved the young boys out, who some found places in on other teams, other, you know, they found other leagues as well, but the Leafs came back to their prominence in 1945-46. Having said all of that, and I'm going on and on and on, I know, but the Leafs were still able to win the Stanley Cup in 1942 and in 1945. Completely different teams. And then they had their mini-dynasty, well, not a mini-dynasty, their first dynasty beginning in 47 with an entirely different team than the one that won in 45, too. So the war's complexion really, really had a huge role in changing the National Hockey League and specifically the Toronto Maple Leafs at that time.
What about the actual game itself? Now, you know, Milt Schmidt talked about the red line when he came back. The red line was in effect. Now, was it in effect before the war and just used differently? What were some of the rules changes?
Yeah.
Because there was also something about overtime, too, was there not?
Exactly. Both rules were new to the league, starting with the 1942 season.
Right.
So the red line was added. They were trying to quicken up the game. It had been a very defensive game, but what in fact it worked the opposite way, because there were so many offsides that were called at that particular time. So there was a great hue and cry about why this red line was there and get it out of the game and we don't need it. And well, here we are today and it's still in the game, although it serves a slightly different function than it did even a few years ago. But the red line was a big bone of contention for a lot of the management and the officials in the National Hockey League at the time. Let's talk about the overtime. That was interesting too. There were curfews placed on the teams, and specifically here in Toronto, there was a curfew of 11 o'clock. The games could not continue after 11 o'clock. Well, you know, for the most part, that was fine. Part of it was just because of train travel and things of that sort. But games weren't able to continue on. Where it really had its effect was in the playoffs, where, you know, I mean, an ordinary game, even though it would have started at 8 o'clock at the time, could be finished by 11 o'clock. It seldom ventured past that. But in the playoffs, if it was tied at the end of regulation, obviously it would go into overtime. And sudden death overtime at that. But the problem was that games would sometimes venture past that 11 o'clock mark. So the games would be called at that point. If it looked as though at the end of the first period of overtime, as if the game was going to have to go into a second overtime that would take them past the 11 o'clock standard, then they wouldn't even start the second overtime period, and they would have to play the game on a subsequent day. So these were odd things that were introduced to the team, into the league at the time as well. Some have survived, and some are, thank goodness, long forgotten. But it was just the way it was back and during the war years.
Kevin, we appreciate you joining us in the Jeff Blair Show. Thanks so much.
Enjoyed it so much. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Take care. That is Kevin Shea. He has written 12 hockey books. He's editor of publications for the Hockey Hall of Fame. His Twitter handle is @Barilko. And it was a real pleasure talking to both Milt Schmidt and Kevin Shea and getting a little sense of the impact that World War II had on the NHL. And as I said, I would urge you to do a little bit of reading on it. It was a fascinating time for the NHL. And some of the stories that have emerged, some of the players that have emerged, are legendary. And just going to pass something on that I think is kind of cool. And I don't know if, I don't think Jamie Campbell would be all that upset if I said this. This is from Jamie Campbell, of course, part of our Blue Jays team, Blue Jays coverage team. It says, for your amusement, Milt Schmidt's 42 RCAF Flyers were managed by squadron leader James Campbell, my grandfather. Now you know how I got my name. That from Jamie Campbell of Sportsnet. We will take a break. We'll return. We'll get you set for the Raptors game tonight against the Orlando Magic. David Steele, the Magic broadcast crew, will join us. This is the Jeff Blair Show, and this is Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. No medical exam or health questions will be asked. Sportsnet 590, The Fan, on demand. Now more of the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Hockey Central at noon is just around the corner. It'll be Millard, Kiprios, and McLean at 11:15. Stu Grimson, the Nashville Predators TV analyst, will join the guys. As I'm sure they'll talk a little bit about Jaromir Jagr's 708th career goal and his place in history and all that good stuff. The Boston Bruins, who will play the Toronto Maple Leafs tomorrow at the Air Canada Center, 5 wins in a row. And they're not asking Zdeno who yet in Toronto, but or in Boston, I should say. But the fact of the matter is the Bruins have survived, done very well, in fact, without Zdeno Chara, surprisingly so. Your Toronto Raptors get back on the court tonight. Thursday, they've got the Chicago Bulls. Tonight, they have the Orlando Magic. Raptors are 6-1. They're averaging an NBA best 107.4 points. That after shooting 56.6% in Sunday's 120-88 home win over Philadelphia. And I made the point earlier in the show that seven games in, we're already in the managing expectations phase of the Toronto Raptors season, which probably came, I don't know, about a month earlier than I thought it would. Nonetheless, the Raptors have the Magic tonight. And the second time they faced the Magic, beat the Magic earlier in the year. David Steele is the Magic's TV play-by-play voice in Sun Sports and FS Florida. You can follow him on Twitter at Steele Magic. David Steele joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. David, thanks a lot for doing this. This is a young Magic team. Taking on the Raptors for the second time this season. What are the Magic, do you think, what are they going to be looking for against the Raptors tonight, the second time they face this team? You know, obviously you've had a chance to see your opponent firsthand, and coming back to get him a second time, I've got to think that maybe there's a few things your scouting has picked up that you may not have known the first time.
Well, one thing we know is that Toronto is going to get to the free throw line. They want to attack the basket. They want to draw fouls, and they certainly did that against the Magic in the first game. They shot 48 free throws, and that was really the difference in the game. I think that's one off the franchise record. They were 38 of 48 on the line, and you know, it was a four-point game, Jeff, with about 5 minutes to go. And then it was kind of a parade to the free throw line for the Raptors to close it out, and they stepped it up defensively. You know, Toronto, you talked about their expectations. I think they should have some expectations. It's a very good basketball team. You look at their numbers early in the year, and they're doing a lot of things well.
Now, I mentioned this is a very young team. The Magic have an average age of 25 years, 94 days. It's the fourth youngest in the NBA. I think they've got 11 players that have 3 NBA seasons or less under their belts. I mean, what's the goal for the Magic this year? Where are they along their sort of timeline of development?
Well, I think they're on sort of on the ascent after a couple of very poor years. They feel like they can start making some improvements. And how many wins that means, I'm not exactly sure. But more competitive games, win a few close games. Because they have been in every game so far this year, even though the record is 2-5, every game has been down into the fourth quarter, a two-possession game. So I think we're seeing some of that. The first thing would be to get everybody healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Oladipo has been out throughout the preseason. He had 2 injuries, suffered a second injury just before the regular season started. He caught an elbow in the face and had a fractured bone in his face and had to have surgery. So he's being fitted for a mask and should be back soon. But you know, I think Victor certainly figures to be a big part of the team. Channing Frye missed all of the preseason. He was a huge off-season acquisition. So, you know, they're still kind of putting it together and making a lot of mistakes. you know, turning the ball over a lot, and yet you see flashes of a lot of talented young guys and what could be a pretty good basketball team in the not-too-distant future.
David Steele, the Orlando Magic TV play-by-play voice, joins us on the Jeff Blair Show. We were talking a little bit earlier with Matt Devlin about the number or the quantity and the quality of really good guards in this league right now. And Elfrid Payton certainly looks like he's going to fit into that particular grouping at some point, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. He's done a lot of nice things. He doesn't shoot the ball well. That's the big knock on his game, and certainly it is warranted. But he has a great handle. He has tremendous court vision. Always has his head up looking for teammates. Players love playing with him. He's got an even keel temperament. Really an ideal point guard type of guy, because he's even keeled on the outside, but he really has a fire burning inside to play great defense and sort of willed the team to a win against Minnesota last week. Even as a rookie, made some huge plays defensively. So, and in Philadelphia too, a win that the team got. So, for a young guy, he's 20 years old, but he did play 3 years of college basketball in the Sun Belt Conference. So, you know, he was 17 when he went away to college. So he's still a very young guy, but has a good presence about him. He is going to be a really good point guard.
Yeah, and I would think when you have all those other factors, you can work in a guy shooting. But I've always thought that if you want to be a successful point guard in the NBA, you've got to have something inside you, right? I mean, there's got to be something that makes you want to have the responsibility that comes with being a point guard, especially the way the game's played now. I mean, to me, it's the most important role in the team.
Yeah, but you've got a good one here. I think the description you gave was Kyle Lowry to a T. You know, he's a very competitive guy. He's a pit bull. Payton is sort of cut from the same mold in terms of temperament. He's very very aggressive player. He wants to play great defense. That's really what he wants to pin his name on. So, and then he has the ability to handle the ball and get others involved too. So it's a good combination.
David, what's up with Andrew Nicholson?
He's sort of been the odd man out in a numbers game. The number four pick in the draft last June for the Magic was Aaron Gordon,
mm-hmm.
Played 1 year at Arizona. So he's getting a lot of minutes at the forward spot. The new addition was Channing Frye, who's healthy now and playing a lot of those minutes. And Tobias Harris, when they go small, drops down and plays a four spot too. So yeah, I think it's been more of just a numbers game for Andrew. He'll have to just be patient and wait for his opportunity, because, as you know, it's a long NBA season. That opportunity will come at some point, and I'm sure Andrew will be ready.
I was going to say, he seems like a pretty our dealings with him anyhow, he seems like a pretty quiet, reserved, smart kid. You think he's kind of got a handle on what is going on here and will know not to read too much into the situation, or, in fact, know exactly what he has to read into the situation?
I think he's you're right. He's a very bright guy, sort of quiet, but very cerebral. And, the coaches do a good job of communicating, too. So I'm sure that he understands what the situation is right now. But, you're just one turned ankle or one major slump from one of the other guys away from getting an opportunity. And Andrew has proven that when given the opportunity to play, when he gets minutes, he produces. He can score. He's developed an outside shot to go with his outstanding post game, and he's a guy that you can rely on if you put him in the ball game.
David, it was good of you to join us today. Thanks a lot.
All right, Jeff. Thank you.
It's David Steele. He is the TV play-by-play voice of the Orlando Magic on Sun Sports and Fox Sports Florida. The Magic will play the Toronto Raptors tonight at the Air Canada Center. Hockey Central at noon is next on tap. It'll be Millard, Kiprios, and McLean. Stu Grimson, Nashville Predators analyst, will join them. They'll discuss the surprising Predators. They've got the Central Division lead, thanks in part to Peter Laviolette. And remember how there was a lot of concern about how Peter Laviolette's wide-open style of coaching would translate to a team that was used to the sort of play-it-close-to-the-vest style of Barry Trotz. Well, it appears to have worked so far. So Stu Grimson, Nashville Predators analyst, will join Millard, Kiprios, and McLean. The boys will talk about the Carolina Hurricanes, the Calgary Flames, Boston Bruins, again, continuing to roll without Elfrid Payton. And, of course, at 12:40, you'll get Hockey Central at noon's Three Stars Again, Millard, Kiprios, McLean, Stu Grimson joining them at noon. That's it for the Blair Show today. Please continue to remember, just because 11 o'clock has passed doesn't mean you have to start remembering. And again, special thanks to Milt Schmidt, Hockey Hall of Famer and former member of the Royal Canadian Air Force, for joining us in a very special time and a very special day. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great day.